Thank you. Be seated. I hope your feelings aren't hurt by the small crowd, but in a second, those meters have been turned off. The court is ready to hear a final argument for the day. In Haynes and Boone versus Bowser, Boone Limited, and others. We're ready to hear for petition.
May it please the court, Mr. Mike Cashel will be holding that argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, this is not the first courtroom that I have cleared tonight. This is a legal malpractice case. The case was tried to a jury on three theories: negligence, breach of fiduciary duty, and violations of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. The judgment was taken specifically on the latter theory. All answers of the jury were favorable to the plaintiff. The damages were submitted in five separate categories. In the handout that I have given the court, the relevant damages damage findings are attached in the back. Those damages fell into two broad categories. One category related to a lawsuit handled by Haynes and Boone, and one category related to foreclosure of a mortgage on a shopping center that was the object of that lawsuit. The jury found actual damages in excess of $1.4 million and so-called additional or exemplary damages under the DTPA of $1.5 million. On appeal to the Court of Appeals, the law firm stood tall and admitted that under the Garza versus Alvear standard, taking the evidence that the jury could believe, that there was some evidence that the lawsuit was carelessly handled. But we did not believe that, by reason of that conception, that it was open season on lawyers, and that every financial woe that this particular party had could be redressed. Therefore, we've launched two major attacks in the Court of Appeals. One, that there was no causal nexus between four elements of damage. One, we did not challenge. And two, that various elements of damages did not represent recoverable elements of damages or were improperly submitted. The disposition by the Court of Appeals is somewhat complicated. To make a long story short,
of the five elements, how many of those fall in the second category?
There are two related to the lawsuit. The fees paid to the law firm, which we have not contested. Amounts paid to settle the lawsuit. Those are the two lawsuit categories. The foreclosure categories are loss of investment in the center, rent, which theoretically would have been earned after the foreclosure, and a deficiency paid by Bowser Bowden upon the foreclosure.
And how many of those are you challenging that there's...
In the Court of Appeals, we challenged four. We did not challenge any causal nexus between the law firm's conduct and the fees charged or paid.
But you're not making myself clear, but on your second broad category, which is it's either not recoverable or there are the charges improper, are you challenging all five of these or the seven?
No, we're only challenging four. To say the lawsuit, the fees charged are not challenged.
Okay.
And you will see, as I was just about to say, what the Court of Appeals disposed of, you will see how these now fall out.
Okay.
Before the Court of Appeals, the court found that there was causal nexus between the law firm's conduct and each of these elements of some damage. However, it found at least three of the items of damage of the four categories under attack to either one be defectively submitted or not recoverable at all. It found, for example, that the rents after the foreclosure were not recoverable at all. It found that the amounts paid to settle the lawsuit were defectively submitted. And it found that the so-called loss of investment was excessive. The court did not, however, see fit, after having found 3/5 of the damages submitted, representing 95% of the damages awarded, to review the punitive damages at all, which is the subject of a separate attack in this case. It said that those damages would stand because it didn't believe that the jury intended to award less than a 1-to-1 ratio. So, as the case reaches this court, our attacks have been pared down because we have won on the rents. The Court of Appeals suggested that respondents remit the lawsuit payments, which they did. They deducted, as a matter of law, a certain portion of the lost investments, which we still have under attack in this court. So the major attacks then that we have in this court are as follows. We still contend that there is no causal nexus existent between the loss of investment and the deficiency paid on the note. And secondarily, we contend that the so-called loss of investment element of damages is not a relevant measure in this particular case, nor is the payment for the deficiency. We also have attacks upon the application of standards of review in at least three particulars: misapplication of the measure of damages review, misapplication in testing the sufficiency of the evidence of excessive damages, and misapplication of the evaluation of factual sufficiency of the culpability necessary to sustain punitive damages. As I reread our application in this case, I was reminded of an informative article penned by one member of this court that appears in the Scribe's Journal. It says that one of the most effective ways to win cases on appeal is to make sure, among other things, that your brief is loaded with dates, the relevance of which are not clear to anyone. I'm afraid we may have gotten close to that in this case, and the reason why dates are important in this case, but why the factual scenario is so complicated, is because we really have two stories unfolding at one time: Haynes and Boone's handling of Blockbuster litigation and the financial history of the development of the center, which was the object of that litigation. So what I have tried to do is give you a roadmap to those two sets of facts and take you through them as quickly and efficiently as I possibly can, identifying for you in the green dots on the handout the points at which the damages under attack occurred, and in the red dots the points at which I think the causal nexus arguments become quite clear. At the end of this scenario, I promise you, I will give you only 4 facts that the court needs to determine that there is no relationship between, no causal nexus established between the law firm's conduct and the foreclosure, which is the only remaining causal nexus argument that has survived the Court of Appeals.
Excuse me, Mr. Hatchell, when did you hand out those documents?
They were filed yesterday, Your Honor.
We don't have them.
So I wanted to alert you, I don't think we've got them.
Well,
so
I requested that they be distributed this morning.
Here they come. I'm sorry, I just didn't want you to get into your argument assuming we had it when I was...
They were faxed to opposing counsel and also given to opposing counsel this morning.
I see them come down. If you thought we were reading something, we weren't.
Well, we've just now gotten there. I have divided this factual scenario up into a period of time before the law firm was hired, a period of time after the law firm was hired but before the default sanctions, which are the principal source of complaint against Haynes and Boone, and then the period after the sanctions. The tale begins in February of 1986 when Bowser Bolden commenced construction on the Highland View Center in Dallas, Texas. In June of 1986, where the green dot appears, Bowser Bolden made its first of its capital contributions to that center. Basically, it put $1 million into the center and financed $3.7 million. In November of 1986, before the law firm was ever hired, the construction was completed and Blockbuster occupied the space. Now, at this point, I think we should pause and take a look at the economics which underlay this particular center before the law firm was ever involved. Fully leased, this center would generate $41,000 a month. But when you deducted debt service of approximately, and this is an average, $30,000 a month and expenses of $6,000 a month, it had a thin profit margin of only $5,000. Things did not go well. Immediately after Blockbuster occupied the premises, problems began to develop with what is described in the record as a punk rock club, which was on the top of this center. The problems were that because of faulty construction, water leaked onto Blockbuster. The patrons of the club were rowdy and hogged all of the spaces, parking spaces for Blockbuster. There was drunkenness and drug selling, which was anathema to the types of clientele that Blockbuster saw. As a consequence, in February of 1987, Blockbuster filed suit. They got a temporary restraining order regarding the parking, and ultimately this lawsuit expanded into claims of fraudulent inducement by reason of misrepresentations regarding the nature of the club. The law firm was hired. Mr. Capshaw was hired to handle the Blockbuster litigation in March of 1987. There were settlement talks with Blockbuster, but Blockbuster was not interested. The assessment of Bowser Bolden was Blockbuster intended to break this lease. In May of 1987, the interim construction loan of $3.7 million was extended to November of 1987. And in November of 1987, where the red dot appears, we began to see the first rumblings of foreclosure at a point in time before the law firm's conduct has been impugned at all. In December of 1987, Blockbuster filed for and obtained a motion for continuance, and simultaneously, the center loses $18,000 for the year. Turning the page, in 1988, we commence a series of posted foreclosures against the center. In March of 1988, Bowser Bolden, separate and apart from any involvement of the law firm, is able to extend the interim construction loan on very bad terms. The interest is set at $27,000 per month, but is to go up in a few months to $31,000 a month. The loan balance against the property is $3.3 million. In April of 1988 is where this whole case, from a causal nexus standpoint, becomes unraveled. Sparks, the punk rock club, which was contributing $25,000 per month, ceases paying rent. Another tenant ceases paying rent. No relationship whatsoever to any conduct of the law firm. So when those two tenants cease paying rent, in the box you see the typical month's operation thereafter to the end of this litigation that faced this center. It only has an average rental of approximately $13,000 a month, but debt service of anywhere between $27,000 and $31,000 a month, plus the $6,000 expenses, which roughly puts it into the $24,000 to $25,000 per month loss category.
Mr. Hatcher, I'm assuming, because I'd like to know where we're going, you presented all this to the jury and you lost.
That's exactly correct.
So where are we going with this?
We're going, Your Honor, to say that in any factuals, in any no-evidence landscape, there are certain trees which are in the form of undisputed facts. And the facts which I am giving you come from the lips of Rudy Belton, who is the proprietor and the owner of this center, and from his financial records. And they will establish the trees in the forest for you, which say that before the law firm's conduct was operative in this case, it could not set in motion a chain of circumstances that led to the foreclosure. And foreclosure is the issue in this case. You cannot indulge a no-evidence review by disregarding undisputed facts. And the facts that I am giving you are not disputed and not capable of being disregarded by the jury. So we see we have a center which is losing $25,000 a month before, in April of 1988, a sanctions order due to some very unfortunate handling of the case by Mr. Capshaw is entered. But nevertheless, Mr. Capshaw, through his diligence, has that order set aside. It was done so on terms whereby certain interrogatories were to be answered by June of 1930 and attorney's fees paid by July 19. The latter was not met. Again, in unfortunate circumstances, the default sanction was entered in October 1988. New counsel are involved. The Blockbuster litigation is settled for $38,000 ultimately, originally 67, then 38. The lease was amended to allow 90-day cancellation. Then in January of 1989, the lien was foreclosed by agreement. The $60,000 deficiency was paid, which is the other green dot, which shows the other element involved in this case, other element of damages. Why is there no causal nexus between the two green dots? We're talking here about causal nexus in the compugraphic sense between an injury and a particular damage. Each one of these elements has to be tied to the foreclosure. The causal nexus argument has to say, but for the law firm's conduct, foreclosure would not have occurred. Blockbuster's presence, free of disputes with the landlord, would have generated sufficient rentals to make this center profitable or saleable, that the lending institution would have renegotiated a survival deal to make the center profitable. Mr. Justice Gonzalez, those facts come from the testimony of Rudy Belton himself. There are four facts in this case to which you can look to determine there is no relationship between the law firm's conduct and the collapse of this center. The bank was threatening foreclosure as early as November of 1987, before any conduct at issue. In April of 1988, undisputed, the center loses $27,000 in rent. This is not shown to be due to the conduct of Haynes and Boone. And thereafter, for every month until the foreclosure, the center does not operate at any level of profitability. However,
Mr. Hatchell, can't an argument be made by a landlord that an anchor tenant, a tenant that has a lot of walk-in business, a reputable tenant, a tenant that's well recognized, is critical to the success of a shopping center?
That argument can easily be made.
And is that generally, was that issue a disputed issue in this case?
No, it was not a disputed issue in the sense that that is true as a matter of fact. It is also true from the lips of Rudy Belton himself that the second floor of this club, of this center, is not sensitive to the anchor tenant whatsoever. And $25,000 of the $41,000 rent was in that club.
Well, let's assume that the evidentiary argument is that they couldn't have made it with Blockbuster anyway. That's the argument that I assume was or could have been made to the jury. The undisputed facts, though, it seems to me, is one arguable. You have to have a good anchor tenant. Blockbuster was that anchor tenant. We have been sued by Blockbuster, and they want to get out of this lease. And is it not part of the damages concern here, proximate cause here, that the landlord is saying the lawyer could have failed to do to resolve that lawsuit in a timely fashion such that I didn't have a problem with my anchor tenant, and that, why would that not, that issue right there, why could that as a matter of law not been a proximate cause issue on the lawyer's conduct of the trial of this case in failing to resolve it in a timely fashion? How come that
Good
could
question.
Not have been
Number one, there was no trial of this case, so we don't know how the lawyers would have performed in this case. And you're exactly right. That is a theory in this case. Haynes and Boone should have gone in and done something to, quote, settle this case. The problem with that is that on the chart that I've just given you, in March of 1988, Haynes and Boone tried to settle this case. No interest whatsoever by Blockbuster. In June of 1987, we find a damaging letter from Mr. Belton, who says, I will not settle this case under any circumstances, and I want to make it absolutely clear to you. Do not settle it. There is no conduct from the law firm after that period of time that shows any form of mishandling of the lawsuit, any opportunity to settle the lawsuit. And the only thing that you hear from the Court of Appeals, which has to leapfrog back in time in order to find any place in this record where you can impugn and the law firm's conduct as setting in motion a chain of circumstances that inexorably led to this foreclosure, was to say they agreed to a continuance. Wasn't their motion for continuance? No evidence that the motion would have been denied. No evidence that they would have won the lawsuit if they had tried it. No evidence that Blockbuster would not have appealed that lawsuit if they had lost it. And the problem was not the handling of the lawsuit, but the existence of the lawsuit. That's where the problems with the anchor tenant occurred, and that's where the causal chain breaks down.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Yes, thank you, court. Mr. Bernard Fishman and Mr. Franklin Hauser present argument for the respondent. The commission will begin in the first 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court. What Haynes and Boone would do, would have this court do, would seduce this court into doing is to create a special rule for lawyers that doesn't apply under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act to any other class of businessman or person who deals in the economy in the state of Texas. They want to have a special rule that says that they are entitled to have this Supreme Court of Texas do what it does for no other party, has never done for any other party, and that is to review facts. This handout that we received this morning, which is the first time I saw it, it may have been faxed in my office, but unfortunately I didn't receive it. I'd already left. The very gist of it is to re-argue the facts. As Justice Gonzalez has correctly pinpointed here, what are we talking about here? What are we re-arguing facts that were submitted to a jury of 12 people that they heard and drew reasonable inferences from? Now, they say, well, gee, we're candid and we've been very forthright. I forget they bellied up to the bar, whatever the words were, and admitted they committed malpractice. That's not the way this case was tried, and it wasn't even really the way it was submitted in the Court of Appeals. And even dragging, kicking, and screaming into this court, they're still saying, gee, it was just a little bit of a screw-up, just a little bit of a foul-up on the part of the lawyer, but not sufficient to lead to the conclusion that the loss of this shopping center is traceable to the malpractice. Now,
Ms. Fishman,
yes, sir.
Do you agree that the evidence of malpractice has to go to whether or not that the lawsuit would have a different outcome had the conduct not been committed?
Not at all. Not at all do I agree with that concept. Or I certainly don't agree with the concept that merely the pendency of the Blockbuster litigation was the thing, the sine qua non, the thing without which the whole shopping center.
I'm not even addressing that issue, I don't think. My question is, you hired Mr. Capshaw to represent, not you, but your client hired Mr. Capshaw to represent his enterprise in a lawsuit with Blockbuster. Do you agree that as a threshold matter, you have to establish that Mr. Capshaw's conduct in the course of representing the client in that lawsuit resulted in something happening in that lawsuit that would not have otherwise happened but for the conduct of the lawyer?
Yes, but I don't think there's any dispute about that. There is no question that beginning with number one,
there's no question that but for the you're saying the sanctions on losing the defenses is what resulted in a bad settlement in this case.
Well, there's no question about that. I mean, I don't think that was seriously disputed. The question is, what inference can you connect the loss of the shopping center to the loss of the lawsuit and to the series of events that preceded it?
Do you, and then is your view that there is evidence in the record that demonstrates that this settlement that occurred at this time was a factor, was a determining factor in the lending company to foreclose on the property, to, it was that factor that was the factor that led to the lending company to foreclose?
It's really kind of the reverse, Justine. What really happened in fact was that the chain of events was, first there was the mess up over the interrogatories. Candace Tyson says, all right, I'm going to give you one more chance. In June, she says, you have 30 days to pay the $1,500, and you have 15 days to answer the interrogatories. Mr. Capshaw doesn't do what he's supposed to do. A new sanctions order is entered that strikes the pleadings. Now the client is standing there bare before the court with no pleadings, and he's going to lose. Motion for reconsideration is denied. What do? We settle the case. Okay, clearly he's under a compulsion to settle. Now, what happens, and this is the answer to your question, is he was forced, in effect, to give up the ghost that he had held on to throughout all of this supposed real estate depression, all of this, these adversities that he had managed to survive. When you lose the anchor tenant, that's it. And that's what the evidence, there was absolutely no contradiction to that. They offered no expert testimony. They tried this case.
Well, of course, you are the plaintiff, so the question is, is there evidence in the record, do you say if there's evidence in the record that settlement is the contributing factor to the lending in company foreclosing on the property?
I'm saying yes there is, but I'm going a step farther and saying that it was also a two-party decision, so to speak. Mr. Belton is the principal of the two entities that are the respondent before this court. In effect, gave up the ghost. There was no sense to it trying to keep fighting upstream when the lender is not going to renew the note and you've lost the anchor tenant. So it was a confluence of events. I'm saying it's not just that there's evidence that the lender was going to pull the plug on them because of the loss of the anchor tenant. They had
the anchor tenant. What he considered to be the loss of the anchor tenant is that now somehow the term of the lease has been shortened to virtually 90 days.
There's no question. You can't go out and refinance. He had already lost the contract because of the pendency of the, in other words, the sanctions had been entered and the default judgment was in existence and had not been removed the first time when he lost the contract that the Court of Appeals found to be the limitation on the measure of damages here. So he's faced with the situation that at this point he's still fighting upstream to get reinstated, and he lost the contract at a time when he was not reinstated, when he had no pleadings before the court. And that's what's not covered in this so-called fact outline here. Another point that you must consider in all of this is these figures that they're taking are highly distorted. The 1987 rents that show, it troubles me that I even have to be standing here arguing this because we shouldn't be arguing facts. But if we're going to do it, let's do it right. 1987 showed an $18,000 loss. That was the startup year of the center. That's when you have six-month rental concessions to your new tenants. That was the way the market was in those days. Every lender, every landlord on the planet, at least in the state of Texas anyway, was having to do the same kinds of things. In 1988, though, if you take out the operating expenses, which are recoverable at the end of the year, and they neglect to tell you that in their chart either, you know, all these so-called monthly expenses, you get those back from the tenants at the end of the year, they actually would have had a positive cash flow in 88, but for the nightclub upstairs. But the fact that you have a negative cash flow doesn't inherently mean that you have lost your property. It's only when you lost the anchor tenant. That's what this whole case was tried over, was the theory that the loss of the anchor tenant was what pulled the linchpin out of the whole thing. It knocked the apple cart over.
What makes it factual, but obviously we're going to have to get into this to figure out if there's some evidence. What makes the somewhat an anchor tenant when they're paying $9,000 a month as opposed to $25,000 for this subsidiary tenant whose loss doesn't matter.
All right. Dan Parker, who was our expert, and again, I say this testimony went absolutely unrebutted. Dan Parker said that an anchor tenant is not inherently the one that pays the most rent occupies the most space in a shopping center. It is the one that constitutes a draw as a high-profile, big name. And that's, I mean, how bigger name could you get than Blockbuster, for goodness sake? So he was exactly right about that. They didn't offer anything to contradict that. And we're in this kind of world-turned-upside-down situation that instead of arguing any legal causes that they might have before this court, they're back re-arguing the facts that were submitted to the jury. And they're saying to us, we had the burden of proof in the trial court. We won there. We persuaded the jury. Well, then the burden shifts to them to show either factual insufficiency or legal insufficiency. And what they're doing in this court is arguing legal insufficiency all over again and saying, you didn't prove that the shopping center wouldn't have been foreclosed on. And since you didn't prove that, and it was foreclosed on anyway, since you didn't prove that, we win. That is their whole theory before this court. The DTPA says, and your concurrence in the Miller versus Bynum case, you talked about this issue about producing cause and special damages. And that is the essence of the whole problem in this case is, can you say that the jury was wrong to conclude that, so to speak, for want of a nail, the shoe was lost, for want of a shoe, a horse was lost, and for want of a horse, a kingdom was lost? That's what happened here. When Mr. Capshaw, starting with his chain of lackadaisical efforts that rose to malpractice, when he agreed to the continuance, that's lackadaisical. When he failed to answer the interrogatories timely, that was malpractice. When he failed to tell his client about the payment of the sanctions, that was not just malpractice, that was breach of fiduciary duty. The jury found all of those things. They're trying to isolate these things into discrete, separate events. And while at the same time criticizing us for breaking up the damages into discrete, separate categories of damages, which were, I think, exactly the right thing to do because they were special damages.
Let me ask you about that. Is it your contention that loss of investment is generally recoverable damages in a case like this under the DTPA?
This court has said so.
So that if
Kish versus Van Note, Miller versus Bynum.
Let me stretch this out. So if, for example, there had been, just to take round numbers, a $10 million investment in a shopping center, and years had gone by, the value of the shopping center had declined, and then all of these events occurred, and it was ultimately foreclosed on. Would you still be entitled to the $10 million?
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
Well, let me answer the question by referring to the facts of this case. There was a $4.4 million appraisal that was made in connection with the contract where they offered the $4.4 million. My client only owed $3.3 million or something like that at the time. So he had equity in the center. And that's what we went after here was the lost equity. And the Court of Appeals pared us down. Truthfully, I don't think they were right. But, you know, it was better to take the $152,000 off and go with that than to go back and retry the case. I mean, that's obvious.
I just don't see the connection between any wrongdoing that comes along at some point in time and whatever you invested in the first place. All what happens in the meantime affects that investment up and down, and at the point that something wrong occurs, it seems to me your measure of damages is what you lost then, not what you hoped you wouldn't lose or what you hoped to make eventually, but what you lost right there.
Right, and it's a valid point, except that the DTPA admits of several different potential measures of damages. Benefit of the bargain is a proved measure. Loss of the bargain, out of pocket. But Miller versus Bynum says that's not always the case. The Chartreux case, which they cited in a supplemental briefing to which I responded, follows the same rationale. What did I invest in this business? What did I get out of it? What's the difference? That's what I lost. It's almost a combination in a way of benefit of the bargain and out-of-pocket measures of damages, and yet it is tailored to the specific facts of the case. Traditionally, both in non-DTPA common law cases and in DTPA cases, this court has allowed some flexibility in proving the damages. The ultimate question in this case goes back to this one thing. We proved to the satisfaction of the jury that the loss of the anchor tenant was the thing which caused the loss of the shopping center. Their whole case is predicated here on trying to get around that by calling it something that it's not. They very disingenuously never use the words producing cause anywhere in that whole brief. They keep talking about causal nexus, which to me is another way of saying proximate cause. But we didn't proceed, we proceeded on both theories. We proved them both. But producing cause doesn't require this element of foreseeability under the DTPA. And I mean, that's exactly what Chief Justice Phillips was talking about in the concurrence in Miller versus Bynum.
My point is a little different. Okay. That is, irrespective of how much you invested, things have happened. Other things that have no relation
ups and downs.
It may be your problems, it may be the bank's problems, maybe market problems, tenants, all sorts of things happen. But on the day that anything actionable in a particular lawsuit happens, there's no connection, not just factually, but even logically, between what you lose and what you invested back at some earlier point of time that I can see.
Well, I see your point. I'm not sure that
they
it does.
They might happen to be the same, but they might not. There's just no way to know.
They might not be. I mean, for example, would you, you know, try to, if the business had a, as you said in the earlier example, a lengthy operating history, would you try to go back into lost profits or decrease the amount by revenues that had been received in the form of rentals? This center had a short operating history. And the loss of the anchor tenant, at least as we proved the satisfaction of the jury, was the producing cause of the loss.
But
I'm not sure how she would measure.
In my example, that's true too. Well, 10 years later, it's just clear as day that malpractice on the part of a law firm causes the departure of the anchor tenant, and that just. And 10 days later, there was a foreclosure. I mean, you can put that as close together as you want, but whether you really lost the $10 million as a result of that, when you were losing all along, you might argue, well, 10 years from now, however, the market would have gone back up, I would have held on, I would have got all my money back. Or you might argue it was about to happen anyway, but my point is, whichever it could have been, there's still no relationship between what you lost on that day, which was the shopping center, whatever it was, whatever its value was that day, and what you spent on it some at some earlier period of time.
Well, except that in your analysis, that really contradicts, for example, Miller versus Bynum, because I don't know that the temporal division really makes any difference. You could compress it down into a month, stretch it into your 10-year, your hypothetical 10 years. I see no real difference if it had been 10 years and suddenly Mr. Capshaw's conduct caused the loss of the shopping center, and at that point the shopping center was worth $8 million and there was $3 million in debt, or let's say he paid it down to $2 million, then arguably the loss is the $6 million in equity. And here what's interesting is that no matter how you cut it, the numbers work out about the same, because his equity, as measured by the appraisal that was of the property at that time, was $4.4 million less the debt. The contract that the Court of Appeals used to reduce the amount was the same thing. So in terms of actual numbers, how you get there may not make a lot of difference.
Well, it does, and because the jury might answer the question differently.
Well, that's true, but that, I mean, the point is we...
It's one thing to ask how much did you invest, and it's another thing to ask how much do you think it's worth? Mm-hmm. Just because there's evidence that it might come out about the same doesn't mean that there's going to be evidence, that doesn't mean the jury's going to answer that.
Well, I suppose that's true. I mean, now we're playing that game of speculation of what if. But what I see is that, you know, admittedly, we tried this case before Miller versus Bynum had come out, so maybe I'm prescient in thinking of a jury charge to submit on loss of investment, but I couldn't really see another way to submit that at the time. And I think it has been approved, and I think it is a measure that is reasonable under the circumstances. I also submit, I know that this is a minor point in this case, but I have contended all along that I really still believe that they waived the objection by not submitting a proper instruction. When it goes to damages, my understanding, unless I'm just dead wrong on this, is that they had to not only object but tender a proper instruction, and the ones that they tendered I've submitted and have argued it in the brief are not the correct thing.
Mr. Fishman, you say this case was tried on a theory that the attorney's conduct caused the loss of the anchor tenant, and of course the position of the petitioner is, as you repeat, there is no causal nexus between the conduct of the lawyers and they say the foreclosure. But could you detail for us, because I'm not exactly certain I know what your argument is, what it is that you say that Haynes and Boone should what evidence there is in the record that Blockbuster would not have left the shopping center anyway, but for the way that the lawsuit was handled?
Well, Judge, I mean, the answer to that question is found in the basic fact that what they negotiated for after they had my client up against the ropes was a kick-out provision that says we can leave in 90 days. And since we now know that they moved down the street four blocks, the answer is outcome determinative. I mean, the point is, if Blockbuster never would have moved, then we wouldn't be standing in front of this court 5 years later.
So, but for Haynes and Boone's conduct, they wouldn't have been able to negotiate a more favorable lease to Blockbuster, which would allow them to get out of the
They could not the have gotten the kick-out clause because, as Mr. Belton said, I will never negotiate. This is what he actually said in that famous letter that Mr. Hatchell referred to. He said, I won't negotiate with a gun to my head. He had said all along, we're going to take care of the damage to the inventory of videotapes that were damaged. He had insurance for that. It was $25,000. You don't lose a tenant who's going to produce hundreds of thousands of dollars of rent and is your anchor tenant for $25,000. I want to reserve a little time for Mr. Hauser. I will say this. There is no question but that the negligence of the law firm led to the loss of the tenant because of the kick-out clause that they negotiated.
Is there any evidence, Mr. Fishman, that the lawsuit would have been won by Bowser Bolden?
Yes.
Yes, there is.
Yes, there is. Two very important pieces of evidence. Mr. Capshaw himself conceded that we had, I can't remember the exact words, we had very good defenses. And then we also had another attorney who had been involved in the litigation who said, yes, if we would have gotten a jury trial, we would have had a good shake in front of the jury. So, yes, there was evidence.
Good morning. In the few minutes I have left, I would just like to make a couple of observations about the case. The thing that really irks me about this case is the position taken by the appellant. It is particularly true in malpractice cases that it seems reprehensible to me that when you hire Mr. Capshaw for the sole job of representing you against Blockbuster and to retain him as a tenant, he then undertakes to represent you and is the most effective attorney for the opposition that you could ever imagine. And then when you lose, the defense that can be raised is you were going to lose anyway. When in effect we don't find in the files of the attorneys any letter to the client saying, don't waste your money on this because you're going to lose anyway. And particularly due to the fact that Mr. Capshaw said that if we had gotten to a trial, we had very good defenses. And so it seems to me that it's bad public policy from the standpoint to allow attorneys who are representing people for outstanding fees to be able to take the position when they do something as incredible as Mr. Capshaw did. to come in and say, yes, I was taking your money, but we were going to lose. And indeed, due to the conduct of Mr. Capshaw, we did lose.
Well, I think that's a bit of an oversimplification. I mean, it's not a question of winning or losing this particular suit, but losing millions of dollars.
Yes, that's correct.
How the jury found the damages.
Yes, that's correct.
And I mean, the whole thing this court is looking at really is there some evidence to support these elements of damage? It's not that. There is going to be a judgment in favor of your client. Whatever ruling we came up with and whatever happened on any subsequent actions, if any of that happened.
Well, it appears to me that in this particular case, the judgment ought to be substantial. In this particular case, we have satisfied the trial judge and the jury and the Court of Appeals. And we're here back arguing the facts again, which is disturbing to me. I didn't even have to read very many of the cases because we're not in dispute really about the law here. I'm up here making another jury argument. And it's incredible to me that we have to do this. But let me just point out to the court what the evidence was to support this. In this particular case, Mr. Capshaw said that he was fronting for Mr. Belton. That was one of the defenses he raised. He says, I wasn't the attorney for Mr. Belton, I was fronting for him. The jury turned that down. He said there was no negligence on my part when I failed to appear for the first hearing. The jury found against him on that. He said, it was the opposing lawyer's fault. They played hardball. They turned him down on that. And they even accused the judge in some of his testimony of being responsible for this conduct. He says there was no negligence on my behalf when I failed to appear for the hearing and when I failed to advise you of the deadline on paying $1,500. The jury found against him on that. He said that it was on his calendar. It wasn't on his calendar. There's a complete list here of things that happened. All I can say is that in this particular case, if you will look at the issues submitted, we have satisfied our burden of proof. The jury has found that if we had tried this case against Blockbuster, that we would have been sustained in our position, and there is no evidence to the contrary to controvert the damages that we have sustained. I want to thank you for your time and your attention.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Please, the court. The reason we use the term causal nexus is because this court uses the term in Morgan versus CompuGraphics. The issue is not producing cause. The issue is not proximate cause. The issue is the causal nexus between an injury which we have conceded and the damage elements which are at issue in this case. Counsel has boiled down the causal nexus argument to one sentence, which I hope you heard in his argument. If you didn't, you'll listen to it again, I'm sure. He said this center in 1988 would have had a positive cash flow but for the club upstairs. Now, what is the relationship between the club upstairs and the anchor tenant Blockbuster, Mr. Justice Enoch, who was in the center past the time it was foreclosed? Well, this is what Mr. Rudy Belton said about the influence of Blockbuster, the anchor tenant, upon the club upstairs. I don't believe that the second floor space for a nightclub would be as influenced by a Blockbuster as certain other kinds of uses. And that is the whole point. The causal nexus argument then just boils down to one inquiry this court needs to make. In April of 1988, when the club upstairs ceased paying rent before any culpable conduct identified by opposing counsel in this argument ever occurred, this center operated in the red. It operated in the red continuously until the time of foreclosure. There is no evidence that the handling of the Blockbuster litigation would have increased the level of this center's profitability at any time prior to foreclosure, and the causal nexus argument is as simple as that. But the causal nexus argument also leads into the measure of damages question, which Mr. Justice Heck has discussed at length. The issue which Mr. Justice Heck, I think, is grappling with is very simple. If I invest my money in something, and And I do not contend, as is not contended in this case, that I have been induced fraudulently or through DPPA violations to invest that money, which is the case here. Haynes and Boone didn't cause the debt, it didn't cause the investment. In that instance, my money then is converted into something. And if my contention is that you have destroyed my something, the measure of damages then focuses upon the something. And in this case, what is alleged to have been caused is a foreclosure and a total destruction of a business. There have been traditionally three ways in which we have measured the total destruction of a business. A loss of profits measure, if it's crippled and ongoing, a before and after market differential measure, or in the case of a foreclosure, interestingly enough, in Farrell versus Hunt, the value minus debt. That those measures focused upon the object, which in this case was the business, and in Farrell versus Hunt, the value minus debt, which is the value of that object. And that is why we say that the pure investment is not the measure of damages in this case, and that is $1 million worth of the damages found in this case. Here are questions.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument in this cause. All the foregoing causes that we've heard this morning are submitted to the court on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will now please adjourn the court.
Please rise. Oh, yeah.